I'm really passionate about apologetics, mainly because I believe apologetics is, in its simplest form, clearly communicating the gospel. I really think that the best apologetic, really the only apologetic for the Christian, is just a simple, clear articulation of the gospel. And I want to give you a couple of lists of what apologetics isn't, what apologetics is. In the broadest sense, apologetics is not uniquely Christian. A lot of my friends that I grew up with are atheists now, committed atheists, and we dialogue on a regular basis. I have good friends here in Louisville who are skeptics and atheists. I'm a part of a campus ministry that reaches out to the University of Louisville, and on a regular basis we have students who describe themselves as deists, as agnostic, as atheist, and I think it's great to be in dialogue with them. I love that conversation. I love being a part of that. But one of the challenges they'll often give me is a person should look to science to explain reality, and they shouldn't have to meddle with things like apologetics. Well, I come back to them and simply say that apologetics is, in that sense, not uniquely Christian. Every person is at some point defending their worldview. So apologetics is not this like isolated Christian practice that we have to either apologize for what we believe in or somehow defend it as if it needs defense, whereas science doesn't need defense. Anyone who is communicating a worldview, articulating it, trying to be persuasive, they're engaged in apologetics, right? Now, Christian apologetics is unique because it's rooted and grounded in the gospel. I believe the gospel gives the most comprehensive explanation of reality. I believe the gospel gives the only true explanation of reality. If your understanding of reality is off, it will change everything, your ethics, your politics, your morality. It will shape the way you see yourself. And I believe that ultimately where we find a true depiction of reality is rooted and grounded in the gospel. And so explaining that is a thing we simply call apologetics. Let me start by giving you three things apologetics is not. First of all, apologetics is not about having all the answers. So if you kind of get like psyched up, I'm going to an apologetics seminar, I'm going to leave this seminar and I will be the Bible answer man. You know, I might get the cape, the outfit, I will be the Bible answer man. Apologetics is not about having all the answers. And the reason I bring this up, I think a lot of people go through apologetics training, they read books about it, and they try to be the guy who has all the answers. And the reality is, because of the gospel, we have a foundation for all of the answers. Because of the gospel, we have a very simple explanation of reality. But as Christians, we recognize if you only have a poker face on and you're trying to act like you have all the answers, people will see through that. Now, I believe we have the truth, but I'm just saying apologetics isn't about you saying, oh, I know the answers to everything. There are certain areas that are outside of your expertise, right? And so I think there's a certain attitude that in apologetics we need to be careful and avoid, and it's this attitude of, well, now I know everything about every discipline. Apologetics is not about having all the answers, but it's about knowing truth. Because we know truth, we can evaluate all the other truth claims, but it's not about being the type of guy that you'll never be surprised by a question. Secondly, apologetics is not about winning an argument. It is not about winning an argument. There are some of you who see apologetics as being a really good debater who can make atheists look stupid. Okay, that is not apologetics. And if that's your heartbeat, and I think there's the reason I'm bringing these up, I think there's something about Christian apologetics that we kind of nurture this negative attitude that it's like we're going to inform you with all the answers and you're just going to make people who disagree with you look really dumb. I heard one person give a presentation, and maybe you haven't been exposed to this. I have been, so I have somewhat of an aversion sometimes to a group of Christians when we get together and we're all psyched up about apologetics, and I'll explain more why I can have an aversion to that. But I heard one guy say it was three ironclad arguments to convince any evolutionist. And it was his whole lecture was framed in the way that there is no intelligent person who could deny these three arguments. I think there's a certain arrogance to that. I believe evolution, macroevolution, is wrong. and for different reasons. But I've never found someone who would be convinced in with a 15-minute presentation with three ironclad arguments. I've never seen that. And so apologetics is not about winning an argument. Now, do I believe Christians should be engaged in the conversation? Yes. Do I believe we should be engaged in even meaningful conversation and debate? Yes. But at the end of the day, apologetics is not winning about winning an argument. And here's why I say that. We have theological parameters that restrain that type of mindset. Meaning this, the Holy Spirit of God has to open someone's eyes to the truthfulness and the beauty of the gospel. And if that doesn't happen, it doesn't matter how much you argue with them. I believe there are commitments, there are prior commitments that prevent people from believing the gospel. And unless God crushes those prior commitments and opens their eyes to the gospel, they will not be convinced. Does that make sense? So because we rely on the Spirit to open the eyes of depraved men to see the truth of the gospel, we recognize we cannot persuade them ultimately. That doesn't mean we shouldn't try. Ultimately, from a Christian perspective, I do believe we should argue and defend the faith. We just shouldn't do it in an argumentative way. As Francis Schaeffer said, orthodoxy without compassion is surely one of the ugliest things in the world. Orthodoxy without compassion is surely one of the ugliest things in the world. And Christians can be known for that. We have the truth, and we are jerks about it. The gospel alone is offensive, and it is very offensive. And so it doesn't need you to add offense to the gospel. Let the gospel be the offense. So it's not about having all the answers. It's not about winning an argument. And then finally, it's not about a brain measuring contest. This just goes in line with what I'm saying, but it's not about showing how smart you are. If you are out to win an argument, if you're out to act like you have all the answers, or if you're out to prove how smart you are, you will miss the heartbeat of what apologetics is truly about. Here's what it is. Apologetics is about discipleship. It really is. Apologetics at its heart is about you better understanding the gospel. That's the heart of apologetics. It's really, as C.S. Lewis once said, and I'll paraphrase, but he said, those of us who are inclined to an intellectual approach to the gospel in many ways can be of service to the church, because if we are not pursuing these things and trying to grapple with these issues, there are many brethren and brothers and sisters in the faith who are not equipped to handle these issues. And so he was saying, the better we understand the gospel, the better we can communicate it, and the more of a service we can be to the church. So it's about discipleship. It's about you having a deeper understanding of the gospel. Secondly, it's about worship. The more you understand about the gospel, it should lead you into deeper worship. The more you think about the gospel, the more you see how everything is defined by the gospel. So it's about discipleship. It's about worship. It's about sanctification. Romans 12, 1 and 2. Paul takes 11 chapters and talks about how great God's grace is, and then he tells them to not be conformed to the culture, but to be transformed by the renewing of their mind. In other words, that they would begin to see the broader culture and be able to understand it, that they would see everything from a gospel lens. Instead of being conformed to the world, they are being transformed by seeing everything from the lens of the gospel. Fourth, it's about the supremacy of Christ. It's about seeing how Christ is above and over all things. That really is, I think that's apologetics. It's being able to watch the headlines of the news and seeing how Christ is supreme and how Christ provides an answer and hope. It's seeing how Christ is supreme over all things. And then finally, the fifth thing I'll point out here, and the list could go on and on, it's about the Great Commission. I don't think apologetics is first and foremost about evangelism. I think that's a byproduct of apologetics. So apologetics is us understanding how great the gospel is, and then a byproduct of that, we're explaining it to the broader culture. Your GPS device triangulates with different satellites to ascertain your position on planet Earth, right? We use it today to find the nearest Starbucks. When they originally developed that technology, your caffeine fix, your latte, was nowhere in the back of their mind. But they launched satellites into space, and they use those satellites to help you find your position. I want to suggest three things that will help you triangulate how to do apologetics. And I'll give them to you quickly, and I want to close with an admonition from Colossians chapter 2, and then open up some time for Q&A. So here are the three things. It's word, worldview, and witness. If you're going to do apologetics, I think that that's, you will find your evangelistic sweet spot is an interplay of these three things, word, worldview, and witness. And here's what I mean by that. First, it's about abiding in the gospel. As Martin Luther said, it's about preaching the gospel to ourselves, understanding the gospel, dwelling in the gospel. I just listened to a great audio book. I have the printed copy of the book, but I bought the audio copy as well because it was on sale. It's C.J. Mahaney's Living the Cross-Centered Life, and is a phenomenal resource to help you think about abiding in the gospel and just dwelling in the gospel. And he has the final chapter of the book is the cross-centered day. And he just gives really practical tips. I think it's the final chapter. Really practical tips about listening to gospel-centered music, preaching the gospel to yourself, thinking about the gospel, and so on. I think that's where apologetics starts. It doesn't start in understanding the teleological argument or the ontological argument or the cosmological argument or understanding the complexity of the universe and all those things. It can get there because I think that's the beauty of the gospel. We see all of those things are just an outworking of the fact that God spoke and it all came into being. But it begins in dwelling deeply in the gospel, in the word. That's where it starts. And then finally, it moves to our worldview. So word, worldview, and moves to interacting with the broader culture and seeing how the gospel relates to all of life. As one scholar said, and I like this, he said, the Christian should be able to hold the Bible in one hand and the newspaper in the other and be able to rightly interpret them both. Because we have truth, we can therefore understand what's going on in the world. So it's about understanding the gospel and then seeing how the gospel relates to all of life. And I think there are some people who focus on the worldview element to the detriment of not dwelling in the gospel. As C.J. Mahaney, to use him again, he spoke here a few weeks ago. He said that the goal, he preached from Jude, and he said that the goal should be that we guard our hearts and we defend the faith. And he said it's very rare that you find someone who does both, who guards their heart and defends the faith. That often you'll find people who can defend the faith well, but they have neglected their own hearts, or someone who does the spiritual disciplines well and their intimacy with Christ is intact and they have a vibrant walk with the Lord, yet they're not thinking deeply about how to defend the faith. And the best is when you have both, when you guard your heart and you defend the faith. So I understand how the gospel relates to all of life. Third, it's about witness. And this is where I think the breakdown is. I'm not going to ask you to raise your hands, but most Christians don't have real, meaningful relationships with people who have different worldviews. In some ways, we have created a Christian bubble, and we've asked you to remain within it. And there's a challenge and there's a balance. Like, I think my best friends, I was speaking at a youth conference, and I had a girl ask, because I kept sharing stories about skeptic friends of mine, she said, do you have any Christian friends? And most of my friends are Christians. Most of my friends are like-minded. But the Lord's allowed me, for whatever reason, to have relationships with a lot of skeptics. And the reason I say that evangelism is the overlay of interplay of these three things, I think a lot of people go to apologetics conferences, they fine-tune their argumentation, they think deeply about the gospel and worldview, and then they never have a meaningful relationship to work any of that out. And so they're just looking for some poor soul who they could have a five-minute exchange with, maybe on the sidewalk, to where they could drop the teleological argument on them, to where they could drop this big apologetic, you know, A-bomb and blow them up, you know, because they don't have meaningful relationships. So here's what happens in evangelism. Our commitment to lost people is basically a commitment to share the gospel with them. That's where it begins, but that's not enough. And here's what I mean by that. The gospel is enough. But people see through it if my commitment to you is entirely contingent upon you accepting Christ. Does that make sense? I'm committed to you if you become a Christian. The reality and the necessity of apologetics, but you have to have real relationships. Does that mean that if you're on an airplane and somebody sits next to you, you say, well, I can't share the gospel with you because we only have an hour? You know, even if the pilot says we're going down, I lean over and say, hey, look, I would tell you about Jesus. We're all going to die. But I kind of have this like 3-year minimum before I tell people about my faith. Sorry. You should share the gospel at every opportunity you have, but you should have people you have meaningful conversations with who don't feel like you're just using them so you could check a box. Share the gospel, check. You know. So, word, worldview, witness. Here's what I want you to do. I want you to turn your Bibles to Colossians chapter 2. And I want to share for about 15 minutes three things about why I love the gospel. And I want to open it up to you guys for some questions. As you turn there, I'll just point out, apologetics is how we look at the gospel. Apologetics is how we look at the world. And apologetics is how we look at those around us. The gospel should drive all of that. And as the gospel drives all of that, that's apologetics. Some of you may have come to, you know, get the latest argumentation on a ironclad outline to convince any atheist. If I had found it, I would give it to you. Our only hope is the gospel of Christ. And a God who opens the hearts of depraved men to see the beauty of Christ. That is our only hope. Now, we should fine-tune our arguments. We should think about our logic. But ultimately, the gospel should drive the entire thing. And now, Colossians 2, I think we see a great template for how this is done. Okay, let me start with this. And I think that C.S. Lewis, people who come to the campus church, and Sarah may even be able to affirm this after being in the youth group, I kind of have like a C.S. Lewis quota I have to reach every time I talk, so there has to be some C.S. Lewis in it. He's not without his flaws, but he was a wonderful mind, and about any Christian today will say C.S. Lewis has deeply impacted them. So to say, for someone to say, I like C.S. Lewis really doesn't mean much anymore, because who doesn't? But I love this response he had to a Russian atheist, a cosmonaut. The Russians were first successful in sending a man into outer space. And the Russian cosmonaut, upon return, made the statement, we've been to outer space, and we didn't find heaven, and we didn't find God. And his implication was clear, that because we could not find them in space, therefore they don't exist. And C.S. Lewis had a classic response. Tim Keller tells this story where I first learned of it and then went back and read. It's in his essay, God in the Dock. It's a specific essay. It's The Seeing Eye, which is part of a broader work called God in the Dock. But C.S. Lewis responded that looking for God or heaven in outer space is like Hamlet looking for Shakespeare in the attic of his house. Of course, Hamlet was created by Shakespeare, central figure of the play. If he was to know the playwright would have to write himself into the story. And so what Lewis was saying, if we are looking for God who is transcendent and immanent, he doesn't rely upon the earth, but he has communicated and he interacts with the earth, we would have to look for the point in history at which God has written himself into the story, which is, of course, the gospel of Jesus Christ. He went on to give, or Tim Keller gives, builds on that illustration through through Dorothy Sayers. Dorothy Sayers was one of the Inklings. The Inklings were the scholars, C.S. Lewis, Tolkien, and others in Oxford who would get together and talk about great works of theology. And Dorothy Sayers was one of the first female graduates from Oxford University. And she's famous for the Whimsy novels, which are centered around the central character of Lord Peter Whimsy. And at one point, now just imagine with me, Dorothy Sayers was single, well-educated, and she wrote this novel series, and she created within the novels the ideal man. Now imagine, ladies, if you're single, if you could, with a pad of paper and pen in hand, write out the ideal man. How great would that be, right? He would be everything you would ever dream of. And that kind of was Lord Peter Whimsy. And at some point in the novels, she introduced a new character by the name of Harriet Vane. Harriet Vane was described as one of the first female graduates from Oxford University. Sound familiar? Scholars who study Sayers' work say that she introduced Harriet Vane to end Lord Peter Whimsy by matrimony. In other words, she inserted Harriet Vane to bring some resolution to the story by adding an element of love, and of course they went on to get married. And Tim Keller, who's a pastor in New York, says of that story that Dorothy Sayers fell in love with her own creation to the extent that she inserted herself in the storyline. That is the gospel. Now, it's ultimately God's storyline, but the gospel, the claim of Christianity, is a historical claim that God has written himself into human history. Either Christianity is historically founded and can be investigated historically, or it is entirely false. Either Jesus really came and lived and died and rose again in real human history, either that happened or the entire thing's a sham. And of course, we believe it did happen. So when you hear your preacher stand up on Easter and hopefully every other Sunday and talk about a resurrection, it is a historical claim. It is just as much a historical claim as the Declaration of Independence. It's just as much of a historical claim as the records of the battle at Waterloo. In fact, there's more evidence for the resurrection than there is for the battle of Waterloo. It's a historical claim. God has written himself into human history. Here are three quick reasons, and for time's sake, I'll move quickly, that I love the gospel. And I hope this illustrates what I believe in my heart apologetics is. It's understanding how the gospel applies first to our hearts, and then to the broader culture, and then ultimately to our mission, to our witness. Paul writes these words. And I love this passage because it illustrates so many of the things I've talked about are rooted and grounded in Colossians chapter 2. Paul writes, "For I want you to know how great a struggle I have for you and for those at Laodicea and for all who have not seen me face to face." He's troubled for them. Why is he troubled? That their hearts may be encouraged, being knit together in love, to reach all the riches of full assurance of understanding and the knowledge of God's mystery, which is Christ, in whom are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. So he's saying, look, he's going to go on to talk about philosophy and contrary worldviews, but he doesn't say to them, I'm troubled for you, therefore I really want you to understand the ontological argument. I'm so troubled, I really want you to understand complex apologetics conversations, how to refute these worldviews. No, he says, I'm troubled, and I want you to understand the gospel, the depth of God's love. The gospel is the antidote to heresy. The gospel is the antidote to contrary worldviews. The gospel is the answer that explains all of reality. The gospel is the hope for your lost family members and friends. It's the gospel. And Paul doesn't say, look, I want you to read my book, you know, the most 10 common objections to Christianity. He says, look, I want you to dwell in the gospel. Look at verse 3. In whom are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge, I say this in order that no one may delude you with plausible arguments. So what's the remedy for plausible arguments? It's a robust understanding of the gospel. Now, it doesn't mean we don't write books, read books, think about it, go to seminars. But what's Paul say here? I don't want you to be deceived, so I'm praying that you will dwell deeply in the gospel. I was sharing with one student, a student from whose family's from Vietnam, his dad is from South Vietnam, and he's a student at U of L now, and he had brought along with him a friend who was a skeptic, and I was sharing the gospel. I ended up sharing the gospel with his friend, and two who I was sharing the gospel with later on became a believer and trusted Christ. But his friend, whose name is Clay, I began talking to him, and he said, you know, there are all these religions. It just makes sense to me that if there is a God, that at some point he would just come down and say, this is the way. This is the way to heaven. This is the truth. And two, who I was sharing the gospel with, leaned over and said, duh, Jesus. And I thought, you know, he couldn't have said it any better. Well, he probably could have, but it was timely, right? That's the gospel, that God has come down, that God has written himself into human history. And here Paul says, that's the remedy. What's the remedy for plausible arguments? It's understanding the gospel. But I also want you to notice here, so the first thing I love about the gospel is the gospel brings clarity to our confusion. It brings clarity to our confusion. Paul doesn't say, look, there are some mean people out there. They don't even believe in God. They're a bunch of idiots. They don't know what they're talking about. They're going to bring you these arguments that, good grief, they're just stupid. There's no logic to it. They make no sense at all. Bunch of morons masquerading for your attention. Ignore them. Make fun of them. Throw rotten tomatoes at them. I can go on and on. That's not what he's saying. What's he say? They're plausible arguments. There's an order. There's a logic to it. If you listen to it, you could be deceived. And if you didn't know the truth, if God hadn't opened your eyes to the fact that he has written himself into human history, you would be led away. And I love the respect that he shows here. Not conceding the gospel, but he says these are plausible arguments. He's not condescending towards it, but he's saying the gospel is superior to any claim that's contrary. I love the fact that the gospel brings clarity to our confusion. If you want to know how confused our culture is, and some of you, maybe you're not readers yet, hopefully that passion God will give you and you'll nurture it, because reading is such a wonderful resource for the Christian body, reading both Christian works and also other works just to be aware of what's going on in the broader culture. But if you want to know how confused our culture is, go to Borders, if you could find one that's still open, and or Barnes & Noble, they're doing better. You have a better chance of finding a Barnes & Noble. And just hang out in the philosophy section for a little bit. And just start thumbing through some of the philosophy works. You can pick up a book, you know, Philosophy Made Simple, Philosophy for Dummies. Just pick it up and read it, and you'll see how absolutely confused our culture is. You know what's scary? You can go to the literature section. Find people who are leaders in writing about literature and see how confused they are on the topic of truth. You know what's even scarier? You could talk to people who are in mathematics. And you'll see in the new mathematics, there's a confusion about truth. I made a statement. I was in British Columbia speaking to students from different universities in Vancouver, by one girl, an Asian girl, who was at the University of British Columbia, and she was a mathematics major. And she came up to me. I gave this presentation. She came up to me afterwards, and she said, you made the statement that the gospel is true. She said, my professor has taught us we never say anything is true. She'd only been a Christian for a short amount of time, but she was grappling still with the absolute truth claim that we can know with certainty that something is true. And she was trying to, in a friendly way, say, you need to be careful about how you talk about things being true. Well, the gospel is true. It is true. And we talked, and she understood the gospel, but what she was struggling with is understanding how the gospel now is going to relate to everything else she hears and everything else she thinks about. And at another session, I made the statement, the more clearly people understand your commitment to Orthodox Christianity, the more you will be marginalized in the broader culture. And she came up to me, and with tears in her eyes, she said, is Christianity going to cost me my career? Well, ultimately, we have to be willing to stand for our commitments, even if it does. But I said to her, I don't think it'll cost you your career. I think it'll probably cost you advancement in your career. You'll be marginalized and you'll be pushed to the periphery. For time's sake, I could say a lot more, but let's just move on. In verse 4, he says they could actually be deceived by plausible arguments. If you skip down to verse 8, he says, see to it that no one takes you captive by philosophy and empty deceit according to human tradition, according to the elemental spirits of the world, and not according to Christ. For in him the whole fullness of deity dwells bodily. That's a huge theological claim we don't have time to get into. Theologians call it the hypostatic union, which means that Jesus was fully God and fully man. And Paul says that this is part of the mystery of the gospel. In him the fullness of deity dwells bodily, and you've been filled in him who is the head of all rule and authority. So he says they could be deceived in verse 4 and verse 8. He says there's deceptive philosophy. But in verse 5, if you'll look back, he says, for though I'm absent in body, so in comparison to that there's philosophy that will deceive you, there are plausible arguments. In contrast to that, he says that they can have a faith that is orderly and firm. Verse 5, for though I'm absent in body, I'm with you in spirit, rejoicing to see your good order and the firmness of your faith in Christ. There's plausible arguments that will vie for your attention and your loyalty, but your faith can be rooted and grounded. There's humanistic philosophies that will come for your attention and come for your loyalty, but your faith can be rooted and grounded if you will dwell in the gospel. In verse 7, he says this, that he's praying for them. He says that they'd be rooted and built up in him and established in the faith, just as you were taught, abounding in thanksgiving. That's why I say apologetics is really at the heart about discipleship. It's about understanding how the gospel contends with these contrary worldviews. There's a band, some of you may have heard of them, a band by the name of Pennywise. And they have a song called Confusion. And the lyrics of the song are these. Won't someone take this all away? Take this confusion all away. We need the answers here today. Unanswered questions all around. No conclusions for us now. That is not the gospel. That is the message of the broader culture, ultimately. There are no conclusions for us now. But that is not the gospel. Because of the gospel, you can have a faith that's rooted and grounded, that's firm and orderly. Second reason I love the gospel, and we'll move quickly. Verse 9. I love the gospel because it brings clarity to our confusion. And secondly, the gospel brings grace to our guilt. In verse 9, Paul writes these words, "For in him the whole fullness of deity dwells bodily, and you've been filled in him who is the head of all rule and authority. In him also you are circumcised with a circumcision made without hands." If you don't know what circumcision is, ask your youth pastor later. I'm sure you all do. But by putting off the body of the flesh, he's talking about a circumcision that's not of the physical body, but of the human heart. A circumcision made without hands by putting off the body of the flesh by the circumcision of Christ, having been buried with him in baptism, in which you were also raised with him through faith in the powerful working of God who raised him from the dead. And you were dead in your trespasses and the uncircumcision of your flesh. God made alive together with him, having forgiven us all our trespasses. How? By canceling the record of debt that stood against us with its legal demands. This he set aside. How? Nailing it to the cross. He disarmed the rulers and authorities and put them to open shame by triumphing over them in him. People can deny the existence of God or the truthfulness of the gospel, but here's something they cannot deny. The nagging presence of guilt in their lives. They cannot deny that. If there's no lawgiver and there's no law, then why do you feel guilty? Against whom have you sinned? If there's no God, then why do you have this nagging reminder on a regular basis that there's something, that your moral equilibrium is out of balance? What is it about the human heart that drives us to this sense of nagging guilt? Well, psychologists will tell us a number of things. Is that good?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Okay. Photo op. Everybody was distracted, and so I thought I'd just go ahead and make it worse. Jason, thank you for taking pictures today. We're hosting a debate next Wednesday, so just in a few days, at U of L. And Nick and I got together. And I said, Nick, what if, to illustrate our relationship and what we're committed to, what if we did a debate where we had a professor from the University of Louisville, who's an atheist, he's a philosophy prof, and a professor from Southern Seminary, actually have a public conversation or debate. Not or debate, it is a debate, but it'll be a respectful, friendly debate, and it'll be the type of debate I would want to be a part of. And he's all for it. And so we're promoting our event, and it's called Good Without God? Secular humanism espouses a morality that they have no foundation for. Secular humanism is basically this. It's basically religion for atheists. There's a book out called Good Without God. It's written by Greg Epstein. He's the secular humanist chaplain at Harvard University. So if atheism is, or if secular humanism is the religion for atheists, he's the pastor at Harvard. And he's written a book, Good Without God. It's an interesting book. He has one chapter where he talks about an atheist author, and he talks about a Christian author, Rick Warren. He commends one and he rebukes the other. The interesting thing is the one he commends is Rick Warren and the one he rebukes is Richard Dawkins. And I'll explain a little bit more of that in just a second. We're having this debate. I know full well the professor from the University of Louisville will be articulate, well-informed, intelligent, but ultimately, apart from God, there is no objective foundation for morality. Can you be good without God? You could be good without belief in God. I will concede that. But you cannot be good without God. As Francis Schaeffer said, the humanist is living on borrowed capital. And what he means by that is there's no basis for the lifestyle they want to espouse. So what do? They borrow capital from a Christian worldview to undergird the way they want to live. What I love about the gospel is it has a remedy for the universal problem of guilt. But guilt, be clear of this, is only a symptom. It is not the problem itself. Guilt is a symptom, and the way our culture treats it is symptomatically. You guys with me? Everybody tracking? It's a symptom. We treat it symptomatically. How? Therapy, counseling. I'm not against necessarily any of those things, rightly understood. Medicine. There's so many ways we try to deal with a symptom, but ultimately there's a root problem, and the root problem is sin. So the problem is sin, the symptom is guilt, and the solution is Christ. It's God pouring out His wrath on His Son so that we can, through faith in Christ, receive the substitutionary atonement that He offers to anyone who believes in Him. That is the solution. But we have to understand the problem's not guilt, it's sin. I preached a youth camp in England the summer before last, and it was just outside London. I was able to do some sightseeing while I was there, and I went to a really cool cemetery. It's Bunhill Fields. And it's where people who were not in good relationship with the church would be buried when they died. And there are several people I wanted to visit, there are several tombs I wanted to visit, to be clear, while I was there. Isaac Watts, great hymn writer. John Owen, an amazing author, Puritan author. I read the book, The Mortification of Sin, on my way over, and I took a picture of that book sitting on his tombstone, which was falling apart, which there was actually little pieces of his tombstone on the ground, which I have one piece in my office now. sorry, I didn't use a chisel. It was there. But I wanted to see this one particular burial site of John Bunyan. And on one side of where Bunyan's buried, he's the author of Pilgrim's Progress, which next to the Bible, I believe, has sold more copies than any other book. On one side of where he's buried, there's a scene from Pilgrim's Progress, and it's that great scene where Pilgrim Christian is fleeing the city of destruction, and he has a great burden on his back, and he is weighed down. And as you know, if you've read the book, and if you haven't, you should, everybody gives him advice about how he could remove this burden from his back. Good, well-intentioned people give him advice. Legality, civility, Mr. Worldly Wise Man, and nothing they tell him and nothing he does can remove the presence of this guilt that he is burdened down with. And on the other side of this memorial site is the beautiful scene that when Pilgrim, his weight he can't get rid of until he comes to the cross. And when he comes to the cross, it falls off immediately. And that's what Paul's saying here. That this nagging presence of guilt finds its remedy first in recognizing its source, which is sin, but finding the solution, which is Christ. So the third thing, and I'll close, the third reason I love the gospel, first, it brings clarity to our confusion. It brings grace to our guilt. And then third, it brings meaning to our mortality. Because of the gospel, we have a purpose to life that transcends our 70 years, if we're so lucky to live that long. It brings a meaning and purpose to human suffering. It brings meaning and answers to what's wrong with the world. It brings a solution to what's the remedy. Look at Colossians chapter 3, verse 1. So flip over to the next chapter. Paul writes these words, "If then you have been raised with Christ, seek the things that are above, where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. set your minds on things that are above, not on things that are on earth. He's saying there's a reality that's higher than what you can empirically test. There's something beyond our earth. And he's saying the above gives meaning to the below. We have meaning below because there's a God above. And Paul said, if you just focus on what's here, you're going to miss out on the meaning and purpose that God has for you. If you want meaning and purpose, you have to look where? Above. So set your minds on things that are above, not on things that are on the earth. For you have died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is your life, appears, then you also will appear with him in glory. So here we see that we have meaning below because there's a God who is above. The gospel brings meaning to our short lives, which are, as James says, like a mist, like a vapor. The gospel brings meaning to that. The gospel brings meaning to the young families who we've had a couple in our church over the last 18 months, where a mother died in one family and a young father died, leaving in both families children, leaving children to be raised by a single parent. The gospel brings hope to that. That's why Paul says, we mourn, but not as the world mourns. We mourn as those with hope. The gospel brings meaning to our mortality. Now, the challenge is most secular philosophers will not recognize the logical conclusion of their own position. One such philosopher who was so honest and so willing and so forthright was Nietzsche. He made this statement. Nietzsche was the philosopher who really is famous for the philosophy known as nihilism, which means that life is without an objective purpose or meaning, which I believe ultimately is the logical conclusion of atheism. Now, I don't think people have to live there. I think people can embrace humanism, but I agree with Francis Schaeffer. You can only have meaning in humanism because there's a Christian worldview that humanism is running off the capital from a Christian worldview. Nietzsche said if there's no God, there could be no purpose or meaning. And he made this statement, it's always consoling. What's consoling for a nihilist? What was consoling for Nietzsche? This is what was consoling. It's always consoling to think about suicide. And that way, one gets through many a bad night. So if there's no meaning or purpose in life, and we face struggles, what brings us consolation? We are consoled by the fact we can end it at any point we want. Nietzsche died in an insane state, and some would say he took his philosophy as far as it could take, as he could take it, and then it took him. You were not created to live without purpose, and you can only find purpose in a transcendent and immanent God. You can only find purpose in a God who has revealed himself, who's written himself into human history. Samuel Beckett, who's a playwright, had a play. He's now died a few years ago, I believe, but a play that was called Breath. And the play was 35 seconds long. And I'll save you the money. It was actually playing in Chicago the last time I was there. I'll save you the money. You don't have to go watch it. I'll tell you what his 35-second play is. You'd be sitting in the audience, and the stage would be completely pitch black, and you'd hear a baby cry. And then all of a sudden, the stage would begin to be illuminated. And at some point in the 35-second period, you would recognize that what is on stage at the middle of the play, it's fully illuminated, is a pile of trash. And then the light begins to dim and dim and dim, and you'd hear an exhale, and the play is over. That is life without God. That is nihilism. That is life with no meaning or purpose. That, I believe, is an honest depiction of what life would truly be like without God. I want to close with reading a blog post from Richard Dawkins' website. Greg Epstein rebukes Dawkins in his book because he had someone at a presentation ask very meaningful questions because he was struggling with the logical conclusion of his own atheism. And he was grappling with it. And Dawkins had nothing really helpful to say to him. He said, well, maybe if you were at Harvard, I would say you should talk to Greg Epstein, the secular humanist chaplain. He said, if you were at Brown, I'd tell you to talk to this humanist. He said, but he had nothing to say to him. I think that this blog post comes from that same individual. If it's not the same individual, it's someone who's struggling with the same issues. Here's what this one college student wrote on Richard Dawkins, who's one of the most famous atheist authors today, what he wrote, the college student wrote on Richard Dawkins' website. He said, in the past few months, I've been having, from what I understand the term to mean, nihilistic thoughts. And again, nihilism is the philosophy that there's no objective meaning or purpose. I've had nihilistic thoughts when I think about what I call the big questions of life. I know that Richard and others have said before that you give life your own meaning and that we create our own purpose in life. But aren't we just fooling ourselves? I mean, in a few hundred years, we will all be dead and no one will remember our names or actions. After that, in millions of years, the human race will be gone. And what will all of this have meant? What end goal are we striving towards? Is existence really the only reason to persist in life? And if you really take an evolutionary worldview, it's hard to get around that, that ultimately it's about existence and survival. Is it really the only reason to exist? I'm just having trouble caring about what seem to be trivial activities in my daily life now. Why should I care about what laws my government is passing any more than I care about what laws the Assyrians were subjected to? Why does it matter? He's saying, why should I care about anything in life? He goes on to say, all these questions, I'm sorry to dump so much out in a single post, but as I was lying in my bed coming to terms with the fact that my life, and the entire universe for that matter, pretty much exists without meaning, I had what I suppose was a panic attack. It was a terrifying experience. Anyone else experiencing this? There were scores of responses to that, and unfortunately Richard Dawkins didn't write a single one of them. No response from Richard Dawkins. But one person had what I thought was an interesting response to that initial blogger. He said, consider the following. Through science, we may be able to find a cure for aging. It may even happen in our lifetime, in your lifetime, if you don't get yourself killed trying to make the most of it. And listen to this statement. Who says we can't have eternal life without spirituality? So what's the hope? Science. Science will save us. Science is great. Science is not supreme. Science is beautiful because, this is Kepler said, famous scientist who is a believer, it's merely thinking God's thoughts after him. Science is beautiful because we're seeing how God did it all. But ultimately, science won't save us. And the initial blogger responded and concluded with this. That is exactly what I'm having trouble coming to grips with. I'm just a chemical reaction that the physical laws of the universe are trying to continue. I'm meaningless. That's not the gospel. The gospel brings meaning to our mortality. Listen to these words that I conclude with. And I promise I've said I'm concluding multiple times now, but this is it. Try and listen to him without singing along. John Lennon wrote, imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us, above us only sky. Imagine all the people living for today. Lennon said, if there was no God, if there's no heaven, if there's no hell, imagine how great it would be. Well, Lennon obviously didn't know of a college student laying on his bed in his dorm room trying to grapple with the end result of where his atheism led him. Can we be good without God? You could be good without belief in God, but you'll not be good without God. Can we have hope apart from God? No. But the gospel brings clarity to our confusion, it brings grace to our guilt, and it brings meaning to our mortality. That's the gospel, and I love it. And that's apologetics. It's dwelling in the gospel, understanding how the gospel explains all of reality, and then having honest, significant, real, meaningful relationships where you're sharing the gospel. That's apologetics.